When the new Coen Brothers film version of True Grit opened in December, it earned both critical and box office success. It's been nominated for 10 Oscars, and it also catapulted the Charles Portis novel on which it was based to the top of a New York Times bestseller list. And it has brought new attention to Mr. Portis's other novels, Norwood, The Dog of the South, Masters of Atlantis, and Gringos. I'm very pleased to welcome three people who have known Mr. Portis to the show today. Lynn Nesbitt, his longtime literary agent, Peter Mayer, founder and publisher of the Overlook Press, which has just reissued all five of those novels, and Carlo Rotella, who wrote a recent profile of the writer for the Sunday New York Times magazine. Welcome to our show. Lynn, the one person missing here is Charles Portis himself. He's still alive, isn't he?
Oh, very much alive, and living in Little Rock, where he's lived for the last 40 years, I would say.
And from what I've heard, in the old days, he was quite gregarious. Why has he generally refused to give interviews?
Well, I think he is gregarious, and if you went to see him and had lunch with him, he would be a most genial luncheon partner. But he just doesn't like to talk about his work. It's just one of those off-limit things to him.
Well, Carla, you managed to interview Charles Portis for that New York Times magazine profile. How did you get him to agree to the meeting?
Well, it was one of those things where we had, through a mutual friend, we had a long pre-existing plan to get together for a drink if I was ever in Little Rock. And the problem came up because when we finally did get together for that drink, the movie was coming out, and there was some danger I would actually write about him. Mm-hmm. And that's what put him on his guard. I got the sense if I had done this 2 years before, you know, we would have had just a great time. He's obviously spent a lot of time in bar rooms and collect stories and characters and would be a lot of fun to hang around with.
And you write that he sat at the bar with a $5 bill in his hand so that at any moment he could just plunk it down and run out?
He was ready to go. I mean, it was one of these things where you just got the slightest taste of you know, the same thing that makes the voice in the novel so great, this kind of regular guy diction with a kind of elevated sort of mock epic tone and just telling stories about meeting John Wayne. He visited the movie set of the first True Grit and meeting John Wayne and, you know, told these sort of funny, knowing, well-observed stories. But the whole time with his eyes on the TV set, whether it was a football game or out on the river, and with this $5 bill in his hand ready to bolt, you know, if I showed any signs of taking notes or you know, in any way making it appear that he was trying to market himself or puff himself up to be more than he was or in any way, you know, wish to be written about.
It's lucky Oprah hasn't invited him on her show. Peter, some people have likened him to J.D. Salinger and Thomas Pynchon in this aversion for publicity. Does that make it rough for a publisher?
Well, from a publishing point of view, any comparison with best-selling authors, famous authors, is rather good, especially if the author has not surfaced personally for a long time. But I don't think those comparisons are particularly apt. There are others that are perhaps closer. But like all great writers, I think he's sui generis and his own man. And what Carlos just told us about meeting Charlie in Little Rock, it's a little bit like when I met him in Little Rock. He'd had some correspondence with me, always very, very short notes, knocked out on a old-fashioned typewriter, you could see. And he would sometimes say, if you're ever in Little Rock, never imagining I would be there, come see me. Well, I was once, for some good reason, in Little Rock. I called him up.
It's always annoying when somebody invites you but doesn't really mean it and you actually show up.
Well,
you hadn't published him. You published him in the hardcover version?
No, not in the hardcover version, but in paperback. But actually, these books haven't been reissued because of the film at all. Lynn sold us the books about 8 or 9 years ago when most of them had gone out of print. And we've had them in print, although with very small sales, all these years. And I think the most gratifying thing that has happened is not just the very large sales that True Grit is enjoying, but the focus on Charlie as a very, as a superb American writer, maybe great novelist, maybe, who knows, that'll be decided later. But and all of his books are selling now. That's what I think is most gratifying.
Lynn, did you represent him from the start?
I did. I sold Norwood in 1965 to Bob Gottlieb at Simon & Schuster.
He had been a journalist before then, right?
Yes, and I was introduced to him through his great friend Bill Whitworth, who was also on the Herald Tribune and who was later editor-in-chief of the Atlantic Monthly. And I had known Bill for some time, and he said, I have this friend coming back from London, where Charlie had run the bureau for the Herald Tribune. And he said, you know, he's written this novel. And so I read Norwood.
Mm-hmm. Had he wanted to leave journalism? Do you know?
I think he wanted to write fiction, yes.
And Norwood was published in 1966.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like a semi-autobiographical novel.
Oh, no. I don't think so. I don't think any of Charlie's
none of them
are autobiographical.
Was it able to find a publisher right away?
Absolutely. They leapt at it. Bob's, I mean, when I read it, one of the things people always ask me as an agent, what do you look for in a manuscript? And I look for voice. And this was a completely original voice. And Bob Gottlieb, I think I probably sent it to him first. He snapped it up in 10 minutes.
It's interesting that True Grit is so different from Norwood. Usually you see some kind of a thread. Do you see any thread in the various works that he wrote?
Well, I think True Grit stands apart in some ways from the other novels. But there are certainly strains that you can identify in the five novels. They're different, but not only, as Lynn has just said, there's a voice that you can recognize, and there are quite a few writers that if you gave me a page, I could tell you who wrote it. And I think that may be true in the case of Charlie Portis, but I think he's always had an eye for eccentricity, and he doesn't just see and present people or things that happen as eccentric. He sort of universalizes the eccentricity and thereby sort of normalizes what might seem to be in somebody else's hands as crazy.
I guess I thought it was semi-autobiographical because Norwood is an ex-Marine and so was Charlie Portis. Carlo, when you were talking to some of the other people who had known him over the years, what did they tell you? He worked with Tom Wolfe, with Jimmy Breslin, Nora Ephron. That was some impressive group at the Herald Tribune.
And they're all still big fans of his.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, and Bill Whitworth, who was the mutual friend who put me together with him in Little Rock. I mean, and that's a subject, for instance, where, you know, he seemed happy to talk about the quality of other people's work, but didn't want to talk about, you know, having been friends with people or having been, he didn't want to appear to be puffing himself up, you know, and I think that's one of the sort of constant themes here is he's not affecting some kind of literary recluse role. He really admires the work and thinks that his own work should just speak for itself, right? I mean, and in that sense, I think it's better to think of him as a craftsman, and the work seems so smooth and easy, and the voice seems so smooth and easy, but if you sit down and actually try and think about why those books are funny, the way he kind of looks over the shoulder of his characters and shows that they're a bit ridiculous, but also has sympathy for the way they want to inhabit these kind of grandiose roles they think of for themselves. There is a kind of a through line of that, and it takes a lot of craftsmanship. And I think that's what he's proudest of, but that's also the thing he doesn't really want to talk about.
Well, even though you all say that he really wasn't reclusive, I've heard that, is it true that when he was a journalist, he actually interviewed J.D. Salinger?
I never heard that, but I really do think it's important that, well, as Peter says, it's wonderful to be compared to two other great writers, but Charlie is not, it's really comes from an old-fashioned Midwestern rectitude that he doesn't want to talk about his work. Recently we asked him for a photograph because we've relicensed True Grit and Norwood, and we're starting with the rest of the backlist to 20 different countries. And we asked him for a photograph, and he sent one in. It's not that he's, you know, hiding. And as I say, if you went to Little Rock, where I have been many times because my sister lives there. He's picked me up at the airport. We've gone out to dinner. My sister's joined us. Whitworth. He really isn't trying to hide. Would you say, Peter?
Well, I think that's exactly right. The word reclusive is a word that's used by journalists when he has not perhaps wanted to do what so many authors want to do, which is be part of the marketing. And by the way, many publishers want their authors to be part of the marketing and publicity. Charlie doesn't. So he says no to almost every request, and actually, I think every request. So the journalist still writes something because such amazing things are happening to True Grit and to Charlie's other books. So they call him a reclusive, but he's not.
Now, Norwood was made into a film.
Yes.
Along with, and True Grit, of now two movies. Mm-hmm. Is there something about his writing that lends itself to adaptation to films?
Well, I think he writes such wonderful characters. Dog of the South is under option at the moment. The option expires in May, so we'll see what happens. Because now, you know, film with this new release of True Grit, people are now asking about the backlist.
Well, True Grit is his second novel, the story of a 14-year-old girl named Maddie Ross, and it's the only book he wrote with a female narrator. Do we know if there was a real-life model for Maddie Ross?
I read somewhere, but I don't know if it's true, that the story that Charlie tells in True Grit is modeled or drawn from a case that may have happened in the Arkansas territories, but I don't know if that's true.
Do you know anything about that, Carlo?
No, I don't. And you know, I'm not at all sure that the autobiographical part really works for him. I think he's a collector of characters and a collector of stories. And I just wanted to further the point about not being a recluse. It's not just in Little Rock. You know, there's people in bars in San Miguel de Allende, Mexico, who are still saying, hey, where's Charlie? You know, he was so great. He was the life of the party when he was here.
But you always just keep on saying in bars. I'm not going to pursue that.
No, and I think it's more that he's just a gregarious guy who collects characters.
He's not a particularly heavy drinker.
No, but let's sort of a disciplined and in a kind of regular guy way, ascetic character in some ways.
Well, Lynn, when you received the manuscript for True Grit, were you surprised because it's such a departure from Norwood?
We see. I don't see it as. I mean, yes, the storyline is different, but still that quirky Portis, off-center sense of humor is there. And I liked what Carlos just said, like, he's staring over the shoulder of his characters.
Well, it's a very funny book. Some people see it as a parody of a Western and also akin to Huckleberry Finn in some ways. Were the critics making those comparisons in 1968 when the book first came out?
Well, it was a bestseller. I think we need to remember that it was a bestseller when it was published. And what is rarely known is that it wasn't actually first published as a book by Simon & Schuster. It was published in the Saturday Evening Post as a serial. So it obviously, and that was one of those general magazines that no longer exist. So it was seen almost instantly as having broad American appeal. I think that's truer, perhaps, of True Grit than of the other four novels, that the appeal is so broad. And Frank Rich got it right in the New York Times when he was comparing two rather good movies, True Grit and Social Network. And he said, True Grit is about something important in America, and Social Network is about a phenomenon, maybe not the grandest thing about American values. And I think everybody, and it's now happening in England as well, because I've just started to get reviews from from Britain, where we license the book. They're seeing it as being full of those values and attitudes and sensibilities that are part of the making of this country.
My guests are Peter Mayer, founder and publisher of the Overlook Press, which just has reissued all five of Charles Portis's novels. Also with us is Lynn Nesbitt, who has been his literary agent from the start, and Carlo Rotella, who wrote a recent profile of the writer for the Sunday New York Times magazine. So, Lynn, you sold True Grit to the movies.
Yes.
Now, it was not unusual for something in the Saturday Evening Post, especially a Western to be made into a film, but this was an unusual Western. Were they aware of it at the time?
Oh, I think so, because the book itself is unusual, and it was such a fantastic role for John Wayne that he finally, got an Oscar.
Was Charles Portis involved in the making of that film in any way?
No, but he did visit the set where he didn't want to this time. They asked him, the Coen brothers, and he's liked the Coen brothers film very much.
Well, the Coen brothers film looks a lot closer to the source material than the first version.
I agree.
And they obviously borrowed a lot of the dialogue.
From the book.
Yeah.
They did, but there's quite a bit of dialogue in the first movie also. I think this second version is closer to the book, and it's one of the reasons why the book has sold so well. Even the Coen brothers, when interviewed, or the actors, Jeff Bridges or Josh Brolin, and anybody connected, they don't talk about the first movie, they talk about the book. And I think the fact that Maddie is truer, and Halle Steinfeld is truer to the character that Charlie wrote, I think is one of the reasons that all these things have happened to it. And but, we have to say the book was recognized when Lynn sold it to Simon & Schuster right away. And probably you were involved in selling to the Saturday Evening Post, too.
Oh, I'm sure. I'd even forgotten that, Peter. Of course I was.
Well, after True Grit, he wrote three other novels, The Dog of the South, Masters of Atlantis, and Gringos. Gringos was published 20 years ago.
Yes, at least, yeah.
So,
and if you're going to ask me, is Charlie working on a new book? he's telling me that he is, but he's not ready to show any of it. And I said to him, look, Charlie, with all this attention to your work right now, if you could just carve out, is there a section that we could just sell to a magazine? He said, no.
Do you see any common thread that runs through all of them, Carlo?
I do, and it's true that True Grit's a little different, but they all have in common that they're these sort of regular guy or gal characters who have a kind of an inflated or a grand role to play, and a lot of the humor comes in the gap between sort of their equipment for playing that role and what it is they're trying to accomplish. Now, True Grit's a little different because Maddie does succeed in going on a kind of an epic journey. But the other books, I think, are kind of more adult and in some ways more comic because there's kind of a greater distance between what the character is sort of trying to do and what he's actually accomplishing. And, for my money, I think Gringos is his best and most complex and most sophisticated novel. And it's about a guy who's just sort of hanging around in the Yucatan Peninsula. Sort of he used to rob Mayan tombs of their relics, and now he no longer does. And it's really a story about a loser who finds a journey, a sort of inflated role to play. And I think, in some ways it's the least comic and I think the most adult of his novels. And, much as I love True Grit, I read him first when I was in seventh grade, I reread it last year and still think it's great. I think it's sort of starter Portis. And I think Gringos and The Dog of the South is sort of the most advanced.
It's a little bit curious, Carlos, that almost anyone who's a Charlie Portis fan picks a different book. It's very, very odd. There's sort of fans for all five of the novels. I love Dog of the South, and other people pick Norwood or pick, as you have, Gringos.
Well, Dog of the South is in Central America, Gringos in Mexico. Maybe we're seeing some kind of a Latin American connection.
Well,
there
is movement in all of the novels.
Yes, they're all journeys
and they're all quests,
yes,
aren't they?
That's very,
and to some
that
degree,
runs
they
through.
Function as adventure stories, don't you think?
Well, both internal and external adventure stories. Yeah. They're seekers in that very American way.
He did also publish a nonfiction piece about his family more recently. You want to talk about that? Combinations of Jacksons. That was in the Atlantic magazine in 1999.
Yeah, that was quite a while ago. To be honest with you, I haven't reread it recently. How did it strike you?
Well, I thought it should be adapted into a full-scale memoir because...
I doubt that Charlie would write a memoir.
Did you didn't get to talk to him about any of those things, did you, Carlo?
No, and you know, I should say that our meeting took place under a kind of set of conditions, which was complicated by the fact that he didn't want to seem like a guy who imposes conditions. So that he let it be known to me through Bill Whitworth that he wouldn't talk about himself or his work, right? Which makes it a little complicated to meet and talk. So he did tell me funny stories. He told me funny stories about John Wayne acting very standoffish to him when he met John Wayne, and he told me it was because John Wayne was worried because Portis is a writer, that being a writer, he would disapprove of John Wayne's right-wing politics, and Portis was sure to mention that those weren't really a problem for him. But, you know, the nature of our conversation was inhibited by the fact that we couldn't talk about him or his writing.
He spent his time when I was in Little Rock with him asking me questions of what's going on in New York.
Yes, he still I begged him to come visit, but he seems reluctant. I was hoping
there are plenty of bars here.
Yeah, but you know, I said I'd give you a dinner and invite Tom and Nora and a lot of your friends. Oh, it sounds tempting, but you know, I'm not sure. I said, well, what if Whitworth comes with you? Of course, to get Whitworth out of Little Rock is not easy either these days.
Lynn Nesbitt has been Charles Portis's literary agent from the start. Peter Mayer is the founder and publisher of the Overlook Press, which has just reissued all five of the novels. And Carla Rotella wrote a profile of the writer for the Sunday New York Times magazine. I thank you all so much for talking with us today about the new bestseller, Charles Portis.